Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Does the justice system provide equal treatment under the law to all Americans, or are the rules applied differently to children, the poor, and people of color? My guest today has devoted his career to ensuring that the court system deals fairly with all participants in criminal proceedings, victims and those accused of harming them, rich and poor, black, white, and brown. But although the laws do not explicitly permit it, he is convinced that the system tacitly favors people from privileged backgrounds over those with fewer resources. Brian Stevenson is founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative. Brian, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
You have said that a person is better off being guilty and rich than poor and innocent. That is an incredibly powerful and depressing accusation.
It's very troubling, but I don't think there's any question that wealth, more than culpability, frequently shapes the outcomes of criminal proceedings. If you have the resources to get your own experts to investigate, to talk to witnesses, to uncover the evidence that may change the ease with which the state can get a conviction, everything changes. If you don't have that money and you meet your lawyer only once before trial, your lawyer has a caseload of 500 cases, your lawyer is a contract lawyer who's being paid $10,000 a year to represent 500 people, you're not going to have your case investigated. You're not going to have evidence presented. Your lawyer may not even talk to you about where you were at the time of the crime. And for thousands and thousands of poor people in this country, that is their experience in the American criminal justice system. Even for people who are culpable, the more resistance that you can create in our system, the more likely it is that the state will bargain and reduce sentences and reduce the process. And so I do think it's tragic, but I think it's absolutely true. Our system treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent.
How do the resources vary? You mentioned there may be contract lawyers. I was really surprised at the pretrial allotments of money in many states.
Yeah. Well, what most people don't appreciate, they know that there's a right to counsel, but what they don't appreciate is what that means. So in many states, I practice in the state of Alabama, there are no public defenders. We do not have a public defender system. In parts of Texas, there's no public defender system. And so that means that lawyers are appointed by the court. And in most states, the amount of money the lawyer will be paid to represent you is capped. So, for example, in our state, if you're assigned to represent somebody facing the death penalty, until very recently, you could not be paid more than $1,000 for the time you worked on that case out of court. In very serious felony cases in many jurisdictions, you can't be paid more than $500 for one case. Well, if you can make $200 an hour doing real estate work or divorce work or contract work, you're not going to be able to afford to spend more than a couple of hours on a serious murder case that's going to trial. And that means you're just not going to have the kind of defense that you need if there are questions about guilt, which there always are, if the charges are overcharged. And so, yes, these caps on compensation, the structure that we've created for meeting the needs of the poor facing long-term incarceration, have really, really been a barrier to fair justice. And of course, nowadays, it's even worse because we have expanded the number of crimes for which criminal prosecution is possible so dramatically. I mean, 1972, there were 200,000 people in jails and prisons in America. Today, there are 2.3 million people in jail and prison. We have the highest incarceration rate in the world. And with this expanding pool of people who are needing adequate legal services and actually a drop in the resources available for this function, I think things are actually as bad now as they've ever been and maybe worse now than they've ever been.
So how does that increase in the rate of incarceration relate to the crime rate?
Well, it doesn't. Most of that increase is a function of the so-called war on drugs. About half of the people we've incarcerated over the last 30 years were people who were convicted of simple possession, marijuana, cocaine, not drug distribution, not high-level selling, but just drug use. And that's been a big part of the tremendous increase. And of course, that doesn't mirror crime rates as we understand them. The violent crime rate over that same time period has been relatively steady. But the numbers of people that we're sending to prisons has been really quite dramatic. It's just interesting because it has collateral consequences, which are also very devastating. We have 2.3 million people in jails and prisons today. 5 million people on probation and parole. That's one out of 100 adults in America is in jail or prison. One out of 31 adults in jail, prison, probation, and a parole. The collateral consequences are so significant because in many states, you lose the right to vote.
Forever.
Forever. My state of Alabama permanently takes away your right to vote. So about 35% of the African-American male population has permanently lost the right to vote, which is changing the political aspirations and conditions and experiences of African-Americans. You may be barred, if you've got a drug conviction, from ever getting a public housing or food stamps or medical services. And women with children who have drug convictions can no longer get that kind of help. And they've become, in my judgment, the new untouchables of American society. And so mass incarceration has had huge, huge consequences for this country. And it doesn't really respond to crime. Like I said, our crime rate has stayed largely flat throughout this time period when the prison population has increased. The difficulty we face now, of course, is that having built 2.3 million beds, there's an economic incentive to keep our prisons full. And that is that's what makes reform so hard. I'm somewhat optimistic that as states are struggling now and they're taking money from education and they're taking money from roads and they're taking money from services to build more prisons, that we're going to hopefully have a new debate on this topic.
Do we know anything about whether criminalized possession of small amounts of drugs is a disincentive to use?
No. I think what we know is that it's incredibly costly, that with all of the collateral consequences, what it does is actually facilitate more dysfunction, more despair. I mean, because with that criminal conviction, you're going to be really hard-pressed to find a job. You're going to lose the resources that you've been able to maintain and manage. No, I think that there's no question that if we treated simple drug possession as a health problem and actually attempted to provide treatment, we could really make progress in dealing with the drug problem. But criminalizing it and taking young people and kind of ruining their futures and putting them in prisons and putting them in jails, and again, it's mostly poor young people because affluent young people typically have the resources to get into drug treatment programs, get their records expunged to avoid all of these collateral consequences. But for poor young people, it becomes a kind of brand that will forever limit your ability to recover, to reintegrate, to succeed. And that's why I think there's no question that it has been a real barrier to helping people cope and prosper and do the things we want all of our citizens to do.
And there's no statute of limitations, right? If you've been convicted of a felony, you must always report that on a job application form 30 years in the future.
That's right. And in fact, some of the more onerous restrictions that we've created in the last 20 years, we have gone way back to kind of make those contemporary. So, for example, you know, sex offender is a term that generates a lot of attention in the media. And everybody thinks that a sex offender is somebody who's predatory, who's kind of stalking young kids and is going to do something violent. But the way we've defined these offenses is actually very broad. And so I've actually represented construction workers who 30 years ago on a work break urinated in the bushes, were sort of observed by somebody who called the police. They got a misdemeanor conviction for public lewdness. And in a lot of states, that's a sex crime. So they now, 30 years later, have to register as a sex offender, cannot live in certain neighborhoods, have to do all of these things. And so, yes, the kind of the arc of this epidemic and what I call the fear of the politics of crime and the fear, the kind of the use of fear and anger to shape our relationships has been quite extensive. It goes way, way back, and it has, I think, very long-term consequences for those of us who are trying to create reform.
Well, let's talk about politics for a minute, because no politician from either party will get anywhere saying, I want to open the doors to the petty drug offenders, and I want to open the doors to people who have done things that aren't particularly dangerous, even though they might be against the law and might be settled with a fine or community service. You worked earlier in both of your careers with now President Barack Obama. Do you see this issue as on his radar screen at all as president?
I think that there's a better chance of getting it on his radar screen. But no, I don't think that this administration has said or done anything that indicates that this is going to be a priority. during the campaign, he did talk about the ravages that have been created by mass incarceration. I think there's some awareness there. But the politics of America make it very difficult for people to show compassion. for people to talk honestly and thoughtfully about how to deal with folks who are struggling, who are in the margins. We've become so reactionary. And let's just face it, the fear that generated a lot of this political posturing is still very strong. It started when Richard Nixon started saying, I'm going to crush down on these activists and protesters and things. And that became a very popular message. It was embraced by both Democrats and the Republicans. The worst year probably in our history when it comes to crime justice policy was 1996, when President Bill Clinton signed the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which has effectively abolished habeas corpus remedies for thousands of people, many of whom are innocent, but just can't get to court to prove their innocence. The Prisoner Litigation Reform Act, which made it very difficult for people to challenge inhumane conditions of confinement. And so we're now seeing a tremendous increase in sexual abuse of prisoners and physical assaults by prisoners, by guards, and overcrowding and starvation and all these other kind of really...
So wait, it's starvation?
Yes, we did a case in North Alabama not too long ago where the system in Alabama is that the sheriff is given $1 a day to feed each inmate in the jail. And anything that the sheriff does not spend from that allotment, the sheriff personally gets to put in his pocket. He can take it home, he can buy a house, he can buy a boat, he can buy a car. And we found jails where inmates were malnourished. This is in Alabama in 2008, 2009, because the sheriffs had an economic incentive to not adequately feed prisoners. And that's the kind of arena that we have created. That law is still on the books. It was challenged in the legislature. Can't get anybody to kind of say, you know, this is inhumane. We like the politics of toughness. We like to be tough, particularly if we can generate that kind of hate that we can sometimes generate when we think about violent crime. The difficulty, of course, is that a lot of these folks are released. You know, I believe you can become what you do. If you're inhumane, if you're indifferent to suffering, if you're not fair, if you're not just, if you're abusive, that becomes the way you begin to think. And I certainly think that has happened in the American criminal justice system.
When you think about feeding people on a dollar a day or less, there are going to be people listening who will say, well, that's what these guys deserve. They're not working and they've done something wrong.
Well, what's interesting is that in a jail, of course, these are people who are primarily pretrial. They've not been convicted of anything. Mm-hmm. Any police officer can arrest anyone on a charge, on an allegation, and put you into this experience. If you're poor, you're going to have to stay there until you prove your innocence. If you're wealthy, you can get out of that jail.
You get bailed out.
You get bailed out. Exactly right. And so, first of all, I would say this is not a population of people who've necessarily been convicted of anything. But secondly, I think that you have to appreciate that the quality of justice in a community, in a society, cannot be measured by how we treat the rich and the powerful and the privileged and the protective. You judge the civility of a society, a character of a society, by how you treat the poor, the disfavored, the incarcerated, the jailed. And maybe you feel comfortable saying, yeah, it's okay to starve the poor. It's okay to mistreat and abuse these people who have been arrested in jails. But I just feel the need to stand up and say, but you are talking about your community, your civility, your character, not just these condemned and arrested people.
Brian Stevenson is my guest. He is founder and executive director of Equal Justice Initiative.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in January. Details at smu.edu/think.
Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Brian Stevenson. He is founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative. There is no question statistically that poor people in this country are the most likely to be victimized by crime. That's not just property crime, but also violent crime. But it tends to be people in the middle class and above that talk about crime and their fears of crime. What do you think accounts for that disconnect?
I think part of it is the way in which we have been socialized to think about crime not in terms of actually acts of violence or individual acts, but in terms of culture and populations and people. It happened actually at the end of the 19th century, you know, when slavery was ended. After the decline of Reconstruction, landowners and the wealthy actually created a new mechanism for getting free labor, and that was to pass all of these municipal ordinances that became crimes and to change the status of recently freed slaves into criminals.
So they're on chain gangs instead of...
Chain gangs, yeah. And convict leasing, this problem of this process of arresting people and then leasing them to railroad manufacturers, to steel mills, to coal mines. And it's this population of recently enfranchised African Americans that largely constructed many of the industries in the Deep South that we have. But because we called them criminal, we were able to kind of justify that. And that crime identity became broader than the actual act of committing a crime. It began to talk about culture. It began to talk about race. We've made immigration in this country about crime. And we use that language. These are not people working and trying to improve their lives. They're criminals. They're illegal. And when you talk in terms of crime and the criminality, we then begin to think that they have no rights. We can be abusive. We can be punitive. We can be harsh. We can be tough. And so that's very attractive to people who are looking for defenses to their comfort in the presence of so much discomfort. If I can persuade myself that nobody else deserves the kind of house that I have and the kind of car that I have and the kind of comfort that I have, it's because they've done something wrong, then I feel a lot more comfortable with that. And so I think that this crime culture has made it easy for people to feel very much at risk, to kind of accentuate and recognize their own victimization, but not the victimization of others. I mean, it's tragic for me because the people that I represent who are on death row, who are children who've been sentenced to die in prison, are coming from families and communities that have been victimized so horribly, much more than anybody could possibly appreciate in these other communities. And yet they are the ones who are never given the protections that we tend to think of when we think about protecting victims. They're never given the comfort. They're never given the support. And so this notion that you're either a victim or a criminal has taken on meaning that has nothing to do with actual criminality mm-hmm. or actual victimization. It becomes a sort of status. And if you have a lot of stuff, you're a potential victim. And that means that we've got to protect that. And I think it's really unfortunate because a part of what we are dealing with in this country is, I think, a growing divide. You know, 38.5 million people living below the poverty level, more and more people who are going into that. And my clients, what I see too often, they've actually become quite hopeless about their ability to escape the ravages of poverty, to escape mass incarceration. The saddest thing I do is to go into the projects and sit down with 13 and 14-year-old kids who tell me that they don't believe they're going to live past the age of 21. And they're not making it up. They say these things because that's what they see. They see their friends and siblings going to prison or dying from gangs, et cetera. And that hopelessness, I think, is very much a function of the way we have failed to address these structural problems in American society, this continuation of poverty. If you believe that we're always going to have, you know, 20%, 25% of our population living below the poverty level, then that's what we're going to get. If you don't believe that that's inevitable, that we can do some things in the wealthiest nation in the world to alleviate the real tragic consequences of extreme poverty, then we'll do it. But it won't happen in the way I think the debate is currently being played out.
I want to push back a little on that because there are people who will say, yes, there are people who have been raised in extreme poverty. They've been abused and neglected and education hasn't really served them properly. And then they go on to commit crimes. Mm-hmm. And people love the stories of the people who don't, who make something of themselves. What is so challenging about finding what is different about the ones who do okay despite the obstacles?
Well, I don't think that we should take anything away from people who can overcome these obstacles. I think that they should be applauded. They should be given credit. But we shouldn't make the exceptional things that they do the expectation for everyone else. I mean, the bottom line is if you, you know, are malnourished, if you have to witness your mother being, you know, violently injured by your father, if you never get mental health services, if you never get treatment for medical conditions that a lot of us have easy access to, and this goes on, if you're thrown out of school because you don't have the resources to do the things that other kids can do, you are going to be disadvantaged. And maybe you can overcome those disadvantages by yourself, but that should not be the expectation in a country like ours. I grew up in a poor rural community. I started my education in the colored schools because where I grew up, the schools were still segregated by race. I've done really well, but it would be a lie if I sat here and told you I did this because I'm just an exceptional person. I did it because people came and opened doors for me. I remember when the lawyers came into our community and made Brown versus Board of Education accessible and allowed me to go to the public schools. I remember when people came and gave me that second opportunity when I had fallen down.
And let me interrupt you for a minute. You're in your 40s, is that right?
That's right. I actually just turned 50, mm-hmm. but yes. yeah.
This is not that long ago.
Not that long ago. And that reality is a reality. And I think there's a lesson in that narrative. I think the civil rights struggle actually teaches us a lot about overcoming obstacles. You know, lots of people overcame their proximity to lynching and racial terror and violence. They overcame having to drink out of the colored fountain and not being able to use the other bathroom, being put to the back of the bus, all of the indignation and humiliation that they grew up with, they overcame and today are standing and sitting with people of all different races trying to make things better. But don't be confused. It was wrong to subordinate people on the basis of race. It was wrong to segregate the schools. It was wrong to humiliate people. It was wrong to terrorize and victimize communities of color. And we can't justify someone's success in overcoming that as a basis for believing that what we're doing is wrong. And I think what we are doing now in marginalizing poor communities, ignoring the needs of the poor, not responding to these structural problems is wrong. And even though some people escape that and succeed, in no way, I think, alleviates us from having to confront these real problems.
We're going to turn to the phones in a minute here. But before we do that, the Equal Justice Initiative did a survey in 8 southern states and found that habitually there was a pattern that found that African-American jurors were excluded, even those who were fully qualified to serve on juries. And there were cases where a black defendant had an all-white jury in a county that had a majority African-American population.
That's right. Racial discrimination in jury selection, I believe, is one of the most overt forms of racial bias that continues to this day in public life. We still today, particularly in serious criminal cases, capital cases, and serious crime cases, find many prosecutors who will exclude people on the basis of race. And that means that lots of folks who work hard, who actually want to participate in the civic process, never get that chance. We had a case in Dallas County, Selma, Alabama, that was that county is 60% African-American, where an African-American defendant was tried by an all-white jury, convicted and sentenced to death. And it's one of the problems that we've seen here in Texas. The Supreme Court has reversed a couple of cases because of ongoing problems of racial bias and discrimination. But in some ways it reveals a problem in the criminal justice system. We are much more comfortable tolerating racial discrimination, bias, abuse of power, misconduct, if we think the person who is injured by that is a criminal. It's that same mindset. And I think that's very dangerous. Dr. King used to say, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And I believe that. I think when we exclude people on the basis of race, from juries, and we get comfortable condoning that, we are stepping backward in our progress toward creating a country where race doesn't matter. And it's one of the issues that I absolutely hope that the Justice Department and this administration will join with us in trying to confront, because this is an area where you can do it with complete impunity.
But technically, it's illegal, right? They can't say...
Absolutely illegal.
Yeah.
Absolutely illegal. What happens is that when the prosecutor excludes somebody and it looks like it's being done in a racially biased manner, they have to give reasons for it that are race neutral. And this is why it's so interesting. Frequently, these reasons are absurd. Well, the defendant, this woman looked like the defendant in the face, and she could be related to him. I had a case where the juror testified during voir dire that he was a mace and he'd been discharged from the military after 5 years. And the prosecutor said, well, I excluded that man because in my experience, you don't get discharged honorably from the military unless it's been an even number of years. And of course, the witness said, look, no, I was an honorably discharged Vietnam vet. One juror said, I was a Mason. The prosecutor said, well, I struck that man because I don't trust people who belong to Masonic lodges. We put him back on the stand. He said, I'm not a member of any Masonic lodge. I'm a brick Mason. the judge still allowed those jurors to be excluded. And it becomes a sort of game, and that's the dynamic that takes place in too many courtrooms, particularly when the stakes are high, and you end up with juries that are not very diverse, not very thoughtful. It's one of the keys, I think, to wrongful convictions. You know, we've had this huge number of wrongful convictions come to light, particularly in death penalty cases. 140 people have now been released from death row after being proved innocent. One of the common denominators is that they were tried by all-white juries, juries that were not diverse, juries that did not take seriously the charge. If you presume someone's guilt, then it's very easy to get to a guilty verdict. Our law says you should presume their innocence. But the more these cultural dynamics and social dynamics and racial dynamics come into play, the more likely it is you're going to get these wrongful convictions.
Let's go on the phones now to JC in Dallas. Hi, JC.
Hi. First of all, thank you so much for this broadcast. When I heard it, I just it was amazing to me that we were talking about this in Texas. But I have a question. I have a friend that was convicted of two counts, and he's got two more coming up in November. The two counts that he was convicted of, he was made guilty. He was given a plea, but he was actually denounced the plea because he knows that he was innocent. Well, nevertheless, he was still found guilty, and it was actually, I honestly think, based on the fact that he was homosexual. Mm-hmm. And this sexual orientation, I think, plays a lot, especially in the South or even in general. Are there or can there be any kind of organizations locally or nationally that would be able to revoke this and be able to go back into the trial and say, look, here's the evidence, and there was eyewitnesses, by the way, that testified in his favor.
Jason,
these are not taken seriously.
Let me interrupt you for just a minute. Yeah. Just because of what you've brought up in this discussion, was this a sex-related crime that your friend was accused of?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And Here's the thing. It was in a county jail, and it was where they had cameras everywhere, so there was no way of proving that he did this crime.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what do you think?
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, in terms of challenging it, there are opportunities to file appeals of these things. But one thing that's changed radically in the last 30 years is that the time is very limited. Our courts now are much more interested in finality in these criminal cases than they are in fairness. And so, you know, that person, if they want to challenge that conviction, has to act very quickly. In most states, you don't have more than 1 year to initiate these appeals or these collateral challenges. So I'll say that. But I also think that the caller touches on, a really important problem, which is that anyone who is disfavored, anyone whose status or ethnicity or race or nationality makes them disfavored, makes them unpopular, I think does face greater risks, greater obstacles to fair treatment. And that's why we have to have diverse juries. We have to have people on the jury saying, no, we can't consider the fact that this person is gay or lesbian or this person is not native born or this person is undocumented when we're trying to decide whether they did a particular crime or not. That's antithetical to equal justice. But without that diverse jury, without that commitment that we are constantly talking about, it is what happens. And I think that there are plenty of cases that have revealed to me that any status that makes you unpopular, disfavored, is going to become a barrier to fair treatment in the courts unless we do better in recognizing the obligations to treat everybody equally.
I don't know that this self-perception is accurate, Brian, but most Americans don't think of themselves as racist, no matter what background they're from. They don't think of themselves as homophobic. Are we making an assumption that juries that don't look like or resemble the defendant are automatically going to be biased against that defendant?
No, and in fact, I would advise any lawyer, you should never put anyone on a jury just because of their race or their gender or their status. You've got all kinds of perspectives. But what's interesting is that when you actually voir dire is the process where you ask prospective jurors questions about things.
You're looking for bias.
You're looking for bias, that's right. When you start doing this in a kind of a way where you've got some freedom, it's amazing what people will tell you. If you ask the question, is anybody in the jury courtroom a racist? Nobody's going to raise their hand. But if you ask the question, would any of you not allow your daughter to ever come home again if she dated a black guy or if she dated somebody of a different race? Would you want your kids going to school with kids who are not native born?
Do people raise their hands?
Oh, absolutely. If you can facilitate the right kind of environment where people can talk honestly. I mean, you know, it's funny. What we talk about in public spaces is very different than what we talk about in private spaces. But these are private conversations that people have all the time. Mm-hmm. And race consciousness is still a very powerful feature of American society. And the way we segregate ourselves around race, the way we think about it, the presumptions that we afford to people based on who they are.
A presumption of otherness.
Otherness. It absolutely is quite powerful. And when we can make you the other, when we can make you different, when we can make you dangerous and criminal and all these things, it becomes so much easier to skip to the part where we say guilty or death or no. And that is the dynamic that I think infects not just juries, but all of us in all of these communities when we're not being honest about the issues that we need to be talking about. We need to be talking about the challenges of having people in this country who are undocumented. We need to be talking about race. You know, we need to be talking. You know, my state of Alabama, we had a referendum 2004 on whether we should remove the language in the state constitution that prohibits black and white kids from going to school together. And sadly, a majority of people voted to keep that language. So it's still in the state constitution today. And we're not talking about it in Alabama. We're not talking about what it represents. That's a recipe for disaster, in my view.
Brian Stevenson is my guest. You can look up Brian's work at the Equal Justice Initiative website. That's EJI.org. We'll be back to the conversation in a moment.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in January. Details at smu.edu/think.
I'm Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guest this hour is founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative, Brian Stevenson. Let's go to Educate in Dallas. Hi, Educate.
Hey, Chris, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate the topic. I got three questions, and then I want to ask your speaker to help me reconcile something that has been bothering me ever since I lived in this country.
Let me interrupt you. Why don't you just go straight to that, Educate, because we have a lot of people on the line. So just give us your best.
My question is this. How does his organization get funded? What can the citizens do? And are there oppositions to what he tries to do? Mm. And then how do we in America reconcile the image, how we treat our own citizens here, and how we portray, you know, the image of fairness and justice to the world, teaching them how to behave while we are abusing each other in this country?
Yeah. That's a great call.
Yeah, thanks for that question. We are privately, we're a nonprofit, we're privately funded. We rely on individual donations and contributions. We don't accept government funding because we frequently have to sue the government around some of the issues that we deal with. We do have a website, EJI.org, where you can get more information about that. Yes, there's a great deal of opposition to what we do. You know, a lot of folks are very hostile to advocating for people who are hated. They just don't like that. I mean, from my perspective, of course, as I said before, it's standing up with those people who are least empowered that is so critical to a democracy, to the success of a democracy. And I think your last question does touch on a really important issue. The United States has been very myopic, I believe, when it comes to human rights. We're very good at seeing human rights violations around the world and less good at admitting to the problems that we have here at home. And you can see this actually in the death penalty discourse. Until 2005, we were the only democracy in the world that continued to execute juveniles. And there were a large number of them here in Texas. And every international treaty, every international norm had prohibited that. We said, we don't care about international treaty. We don't care about international norms. But of course we do. We rely on them in so many spheres. But when they're not in our interest, we don't tend to do the things we need to do. The U.S. is the only country in the world that has not signed, are the only two countries that have not signed the Covenant on the Rights of the Child, which in part because it prohibits the death penalty and life in prison for juveniles. I think we're ultimately going to have to reconcile our global status. I believe our reputation as a world leader on human rights has actually been undermined by some of our criminal justice policies, which are considered barbaric in many parts of the world. And if we want to kind of be the model and the engine that promotes human rights around the world, we're going to have to take care of some things here domestically. And that's a difficult conversation for Americans to hear, but I think it's a necessary conversation.
The Supreme Court did last spring prohibit life without parole sentences for crimes committed by minors other than homicide.
That's correct, yes. We had started that work about 4 years ago. The United States is the only country in the world where children as young as 13 have been sentenced to die in prison, some for non-homicides. And again, it's one of these issues where, again, globally, internationally, that wouldn't happen because they have laws that prohibit that. And it was always difficult for me, you know, to say to my client, well, yeah, if you were in Cuba, if you were in Saudi Arabia, if you were in North Korea, you know, this wouldn't be legal, but in the United States it is. The court did strike that down, a 5-4 decision, declaring that punishment cruel and unusual. We're trying to implement that now. But I think we still need to extend that. We need to talk about that in other categories. Children are different from adults. A 13-year-old is not a 30-year-old. And when we don't recognize that, I think we do something to the status of children outside of the criminal justice system that is destructive. But again, this kind of politics of crime got us into this place. We were so intent on punishing offenders, we said we didn't care how young they are. And there are states in America today where even children as young as 7 and 8 can be tried and prosecuted as adults. It's hard to reconcile that with the kind of knowledge and understanding we have about the needs of kids, but it's an example of the ways in which our criminal justice system frequently does not deal with these issues in the thoughtful, rational way that they have to be dealt with.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next on the phones to Robert in Dallas. Hi, Robert.
Hi, how are you guys?
Great, thank you.
I know you have a lot of people on the line, so I'll try to make it quick. I wanted to move back to kind of economic and educational disparities. My question is, what do you think are effective ways to kind of turn the tide of a capitalistic culture that understands the role of wealth as a means to kind of pad my own mattress or make my own life more comfortable while ignoring those who don't have those kind of comforts? I mean, we're talking about starving people and with no education and no health care and all kinds of terrible things. But how do you change someone's mind who would rather spend, you know, $300 to go to a Dallas Cowboys game than spend $300 to buy school supplies for some kids who don't have any? I mean, how do you go about doing that?
Yeah, I think that there are two things. I think we have to be kind of crude enough to kind of talk to the economics of it to get people to think differently about it. And policies, particularly in the criminal justice system, have been presented that way. So, for example, you know, we have laws that require life without parole for habitual felony offenders. That people don't appreciate that you can write 4 bad checks in some states and end up with a life without parole sentence. And so when I say crude, I'm saying to those decision makers, to those policymakers, look, this guy wrote 3 bad checks for $50. His 4th check was for $60. We're now going to spend $20,000 a year for the next 70 years to keep him in prison because we want to be tough.
And in some cases, the law requires that. Judges and juries don't have a choice.
That's right. Mandatory life without parole. And I'd say to them, that's just not smart. If you want more money for all of the things that you value, you cannot afford to engage in that kind of misguided punishment. And that's the kind of the crude, not crude, but the direct economic analysis. And I think that applies in a variety of contexts. When we don't educate kids, when we don't take care of kids in the early adolescent stages, we're going to end up spending a lot more to manage them in other capacities. And so we can make this economic analysis part of the discussion. But I also think that there is this kind of moral, this kind of aspirational worldview that we should also be engaged in. I don't believe that in the United States, the opposite of poverty is wealth. I really don't. I think in this country that the opposite of poverty is justice. And we have to recognize that if we are a just society, we do not tolerate the homelessness, the hunger, the despair, the dysfunction that exists in too many poor communities, that to be just means to care for those around us, to take care of the whole, to have a vision of what it means to be in community that is not just me, 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 but us, us, us. Because ultimately, we all need each other at these moments and spaces when we're in crisis. And that part of the conversation, I think, is also important. We can't ignore that while we're doing the hard economic stuff. And I think the combination of the two might motivate us to think a little more broadly, to be a little more merciful, to be a little more compassionate and hopeful about what we can do about the problems of poverty.
Next on the line, we have Sharon in Irving. Hi, Sharon.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And thank you for this really enlightening discussion. I want to get your guest, if you would, to comment on a slightly different aspect of the drug problem that, than what was discussed a little earlier. You talked about the mass incarceration of people who are there for drug-related crimes and also the convictions of those on the street and the residual effects those convictions have. I'd like you to address, if you would, a slightly different class of drug offender. These would be people who are not convicted because they've used illegal substances, but have been convicted because how they obtained legal substances, many of whom became addicted to prescription drugs mm-hmm. through medical reasons, doctors, carelessness, or whatever. And these folks are now in a similar situation to what everyone else who's been incarcerated or convicted of drug-related crimes are.
Well, let's get a response for you today.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. We've seen tremendous increases in the number of arrests and prosecutions and a wide range of things that are considered drug crimes. And it does include prescription drug abuse. It does include medical mismanagement of drugs and things like that. I think the general problem is that we fail to recognize that drug use is, in most instances, a healthcare problem. If we thought about it as a healthcare problem, our goal would be to get people in the place that we want them to be, where they're not drug dependent, where they're not using drugs that are not appropriate for them, where their lives aren't being disrupted by that. And that's what we do with other kinds of medical issues. And if we did that, I think we would be dealing with all of these categories of offending in a much more responsible and effective way. Countries that have actually taken that approach have had real progress, have seen real progress. There's some really outstanding treatment programs around the country that have made huge differences in the lives of people simply because they said, look, we don't care about the criminality. We care about this as a healthcare. We want to talk to you about the health and science and your basic personal needs with regard to this drug issue, and get you to a place where you can be strong and healthy. And that's worked really effectively in the places where it's been tried.
Well, let's move beyond drug use when we're talking about health. The sheriff of Dallas County has described the jail system that she runs as the largest mental health facility in Dallas County. And so how does that play? You know, and she certainly acknowledges the fact that they have committed other crimes. Yeah. But she doesn't feel like they're best served in jail.
No, I think right behind the war on drugs as an explanation of this mass incarceration is the way in which we have, over the last 30 years, incarcerated more and more mentally ill people. Our commitment to social control, to wanting all of the difficult and hard-to-manage people in jails and prisons, has meant that we incarcerate them constantly. And I have no doubt. I think she's absolutely right. I don't know that jail, but in my experience, people with depression, unmedicated, untreated, people with schizophrenia, people who are poor and don't have the resources for adequate management of mental health problems end up in jail and prison. And it's a nightmare for people who have to manage these facilities. It's not good for the clients. It's not good for other prisoners. It's a disaster. But until we begin thinking about the needs of the mentally ill, and I'm talking here about the poor mentally ill, because affluent mentally ill people can typically get the resources they need to stay out of jails and prisons. Not always, but typically. Until we recognize those needs, this phenomenon will continue. There used to be a time when we provided mental health treatment to people in jails and prisons. The economy and the economics of mass incarceration have made it very difficult to do anything to people in prison other than to warehouse them. No more education, no more Pell Grants, no more teaching, no more training, no more mental health services, no more medical services. Most states require people in jails and prisons to pay to see the doctor. So that if you're having a cough and it won't go away and you want to see the doctor, you have to have $3 on your books before they will let you see the doctor, even though that might be tuberculosis. And even though that untreated tuberculosis might infect guards and other people and create a health crisis in the community, we still say we're not going to deal with you until you have your $3. It's not a healthy, sensible way to deal with the health problems of prisoners, but it's the way we, again, have embraced this notion that if you're in prison, if you're condemned, if you're incarcerated, we can ignore your rights, we can ignore your basic needs, we can treat you like some animal. And that's a prescription, I think, for the kinds of chaos and disaster that we're beginning to see.
Is the death penalty always wrong?
Yes, I think the death penalty is always wrong. Even if you believe that the death penalty can be moral in some circumstances, it's just in some circumstances, and I respect that perspective. I think in this country, where we have a system that is so unreliable, where race and poverty are going to shape outcomes. We've made so many mistakes. Even if the death penalty would be right in the abstract, it's wrong in every instance. I don't believe that in this country you can have a death penalty with the kinds of problems that we have. It's not that people don't deserve to be killed. It's that we don't deserve to kill. And when we have the kind of discrimination, we have the kind of inequality, when money and race and all these things are shaping outcomes, we can't say we deserve to make these kinds of perfect judgments. And that's why I think it's always wrong. I also think that we are all more than the worst thing we've ever done. I don't think you can reduce any human being to their worst act and judge only that act responsibly. I think if somebody tells a lie, they're not just a liar. I think if somebody takes something that doesn't belong to them, they're not just a thief. And I think even if you kill somebody, you're not just a killer. And because of that, we've got to be interested in redemption and the humanity and the dignity that every life possesses and respect that. I know that not everybody agrees with that. I know that not everybody embraces that, but that's certainly what I think. But I think even if you think that the death penalty can be right in some circumstances, you've got to have a system of justice that is 100% reliable, that is always accurate, before you can comfortably say, we deserve to kill.
It sounds like we're a long way away from that.
Yes, no, I think we absolutely are a long way from that.
Brian Stevenson is founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative. Brian, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
My pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.